Okay. Psalm 15 is a fairly short psalm, and one that breaks a little bit from what we've seen over the past many weeks, where this psalm is not contemplating intrinsically or directly the wickedness of evil men and their coming judgment, although that's always, at least as far as this is concerned, there's a little bit of a undertone to that by contrast. But this one is one of a more positive psalm. It's contemplating a positive aspect of man, of man's character, of man's obedience, of man's righteousness. And so it creates in that a little bit of a break from what we've dealt with and some of the heaviness that we've dealt with in the psalms thus far. Psalm 15, as always, I'll go ahead and read the psalm for you, and then we'll talk about it a little bit together. Psalm 15, a psalm of David. Lord, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness, and speaketh the truth in his heart. He that backbiteth not with his tongue, nor doeth evil to his neighbor, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor. In whose eyes a vile person is contemned, but he honoreth them that fear the Lord. He that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not. He that putteth not out his money to usury, nor taketh reward against the innocent. He that doeth these things shall never be moved. So you can see perhaps why I call this a positive psalm. It's contemplating positive virtues by which we seek unto that which is right. Very similar, in fact, to Psalm 1, right? Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly. So this is a psalm of David, and it asks and answers a single question. Some of the other ones have various avenues or angles to them, not so much the psalm. Words are very similar to the words of Psalm 24. We're not going to compare them as we did with Psalm 14 directly. When we were in Psalm 14, we were comparing very closely, but it is very similar to Psalm 24. Psalm 24 was written in the context of the ark coming to Jerusalem. We see very similar language here, however, it's more general. Many contemplate this being connected to David's flight with Absalom, which, as I've said, week in and week out, almost every one of these psalms can generally be perhaps connected to David's flight with Absalom from the context. We're not sure, perhaps David asking whether Absalom's behavior would qualify him to represent God to the people. The idea being that perhaps David is writing this as he considers Absalom's attempt to overthrow, and maybe before David had the fullest assurance of him being restored, because basically what he said is, I'm in the Lord's hand. If the Lord have favor, he'll restore me. If he doesn't, then he won't, right? And perhaps in that time, David is contemplating two things. First, that David has sought to be this kind of man. And second, will Absalom be able to be a theocratic or theonomic representative in his state of unrighteousness? And so perhaps that is the context. Again, we do not know. And one of the things that I've personally enjoyed doing over the last many weeks is trying to think through that. When might this have been written and under what circumstances? And it's a fruitful and somewhat enjoyable effort, at least for me, to kind of contemplate the scenarios in David's life and when it might be that David might think through this. Of course, we could think of this as it relates to perhaps Doeg and David's interaction with Doeg. We do know of other psalms written in regard to David's interaction with Doeg later on in the Psalms. So just thinking through that, we don't really know. But Psalm 15, excuse me, beginning in verse 1, the Bible says, a psalm of David. And then here's the question. It's two questions, but it's really one. Lord, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? We see here what I've called, as far as parallelism is concerned in the psalm, a synonymous parallelism between these two questions. The tabernacle is on God's holy hill, right? At least it was at the point of David having brought the ark into Jerusalem. Before that, we know that the tabernacle had been in Shiloh primarily, but David does bring these things together. And then, of course, who shall abide or who shall dwell? And so we see this idea of abiding and dwelling in the tabernacle upon God's holy hill. And it is not insignificant to consider how David regarded having the ark and the tabernacle in Jerusalem, how important that was to him. We know that when he brought it up, of course, he first tries to bring it up, and then he ends up not bringing it up right away because of the judgment of the Lord as it was coming up. And then we see him finally bring it up from Jerusalem, and he comes in with dancing, and Michael's not happy about that, and all of the various elements about this joyous occasion when the tabernacle, when the Ark of the Covenant comes into Jerusalem and then is brought into the tabernacle and is, as it were, reunited with the tabernacle after the years of with the Philistines and then such. And so we see here this question. But we also do recognize a very clear metaphorical or a spiritual idea here. Not just the idea of who is able. You can go back to the law and you can think through the cleansing rituals, right, that would allow a person to go into the tabernacle. The Day of Atonement and the high priestly rituals by which on that one day of the year a priest could go into the Holy of Holies and sprinkle blood on the mercy seat and these sorts of things. And so we can think through that practically, but we know that that's not what David is talking about here, right? What David is talking about is who shall abide in the presence of the Lord. And there's a definite heightened idea of who will stand before him in eternity. And who shall have fellowship with God, as we see. Fellowship with God actualized through the tabernacle. Very similar to what we see with the Lord's table or baptism. We know that the Lord's table, and I spoke about this on Sunday as well, the Lord's table is not actually, contrary to the opinion of some of the liturgical denominations, is not actually the body and the blood of Jesus Christ, right? The Lord's table is intended to be a metaphorical representation of a heightened spiritual reality. And it's the same with baptism. Water baptism does not actually do anything for the soul in an effectual way, save that it is a metaphorical representation of a heightened spiritual reality in one's life. And we could talk about both of these as a step of obedience. And as a step of obedience, there is a clear and distinct blessing upon those who enact them in their lives because you are obeying and submitting to the word of the Lord. But as far as the actual one-to-one idea of the act of baptism itself has a spiritual and efficacious spiritual effect on me, we know that that is not what the Bible teaches. The act of physical baptism is an outward manifestation of that which has been inwardly realized already through the spirit baptism, being buried with him by baptism into death and raised to walk in newness of life, as Romans chapter 6 speaks to. And David is kind of speaking along those same terms here, that he's saying who will abide in fellowship with the Lord, who will stand before the Lord with rightness, and then as we get toward the end of the psalm that we see here who will never be moved, right? Who will stand before the Lord in confidence? And that's the question. The rest of the verses are the answer to that question. And as we've seen, it's very common, especially in these early Psalms of David, for the first verse or the first statement or the first question or the first couple of verses to be thematic. And then everything after that is aligned with that theme. Of course, we see that here. Verse 2 is the beginning of the answer. He that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh the truth in his heart. That word uprightly is a word which means entirely. He that walketh entirely in wholeness. And that is extrapolated to the idea of walking in integrity or walking in truth. And we see several of these ideas being directly related to the concept of not being hypocritical. So the concept of walking uprightly and working righteousness here and speaking truth in his heart should not be seen, as we know from the Word of God, as the man who is sinlessly perfect, but rather the man who is walking in honesty with himself and thus whatever submission or outward acts he has toward the Lord, these are genuine acts. And this is a very important concept as it relates to the difference between a religion and a relationship, right? And it's very important here that as we consider David's contemplation of the tabernacle, he is not contemplating the tabernacle in the context here of religious ordinance. He is contemplating the tabernacle in the context of personal relationship. And how important is that as it relates to the nature of what would end up happening by the time Herod's temple is built and by the time of Jesus' day, where the temple was literally an ordinance-only institution, right? And in many parts of Jewish history, it has either been an ordinance-only institution where it's only about the religiosity of the temple and the tabernacle. Do this, don't do that, be cleansed. All of the just so religious elements, or it's been a good luck charm, right? As in the early days of the judges, or the late days of the judges, when they bring the ark to the encampment against the Philistines as a means by which to either manipulate God or gain favor with God in order to win the battle. And of course, that does not work. But the same thing can be said in Jeremiah's day and in Isaiah's day, where Jeremiah has to rebuke the nation of Israel, and specifically the kings, who think in their heart, Jerusalem cannot fall because the Lord's tabernacle is here, because the Lord's temple is here. And so they had this, and that was probably going back to the days of Hezekiah, right, and whatnot, when the kings would come against Israel and they'd be destroyed by God's hand. And so going back to that kind of traditional idea, the kings in Jeremiah's day had gotten to the point where they said, Jerusalem can't be destroyed. This is where God's house is. It's the same with Ezekiel, right? Ezekiel sees the visions of all of the terrible things happening in Jerusalem, and then he sees the glory of the Lord depart from the tabernacle or the temple and then depart from Jerusalem and ascend at the Mount of Olives. And he sees all of this in a vision. And the idea there that Ezekiel is proposing to the people is, quit with this silly notion that God will not allow this city to be destroyed. He's already removed his presence and his blessing from the city. There's nothing left here that is sacred. You're not treating it as sacred. God has now removed his sacredness. So don't think this cannot be destroyed, because this is little more than brick and stone and mortar and mud. And so we see here that David is not viewing the tabernacle in this sort of a way, in this religious sort of a way per se. He's viewing the tabernacle as a metaphorical representation of the relationship between a man and God. Who shall abide in God's tabernacle? Who will dwell in his presence? The man who walks entirely. The man who does not walk in contradiction to himself. I love the way that is described, entirely. How often do we present a half of ourselves? We talked about it a little bit Sunday night. And this idea of accountability and serving and loving one another. How often are we not actually whole? And that's really what integrity is. Integrity is when I am who I am. And I am living out the reality of who I am. I'm thus living in integrity. Righteousness. Of course, this is the tzedek. This is the standard word in the Old Testament for righteous or righteousness, that which is right, right? That which is upright, that which is morally right, that which is right before the Lord. And then speaking the truth in his heart, as we've said, is this idea of an unhypocritical nature, that I'm not fooling myself. I'm not pretending to be something I am not. And I love this idea, this description of the man that will stand before God. Because it hearkens so much to the idea of James, God resisteth the proud but giveth grace to the humble. Right? That there is a humility that in order for a man to be honest with himself, he must have a measure of humility. He must, as he sees himself for who he is and as he lives as a natural extension of who he is, not in hypocrisy, not in double-mindedness, but living these things out in integrity. This is the man that will stand before the Lord. And as I describe this, I say these three synonymous ideas revolve around the ideas of equity and sincerity. And I say here, let's define the word equity. Equity is a word that's coming up a lot in our culture lately. because there's a debate between equity versus equality, right? And in society, what is being pushed now is an attempt to make society equitable, as opposed to having in society equality. And the difference is that equality is when, such as being equal before the law, equality is when every man is treated in the same fashion, right? So that you and I are operating under the same rules and the same benefits and the same consequences. So if I do, if you and I pursue the same course of action and have the same drive and the same opportunities set before us, and we both take advantage of those opportunities, we will arrive in a similar place as we take advantage of those opportunities. Equality is about the opportunity, the having the same opportunities. Equity is an outcome-based idea. So equity is not the having the same opportunities. Equity is having the same outcomes. And of course, this is a big problem in society, right? The idea that we want to bring about the same outcomes because one person is lazy and the other person works hard. And yet we want them to get to the same place, which means what? We have to take from the person that works hard and give it to the person that's lazy in order that they can have the same outcome. And that's equity. Equity is the idea of bringing about a balance. Now, in society, we don't ever want to shoot for equity because equity cannot happen in a society of sinful men. But in my heart, there can be equity. In other words, that there is a balance in my heart whereby who I am is what I represent, and what I represent is who is what I do. And so in my heart, there is a rightness. There is a justice. There is a balance. There is a sincerity and a lack of hypocrisy. So I use that word equity here carefully, not to say that there ought to be equity as it, I'm not talking about society or anything of the sort, but we are saying that in our hearts, in myself, I manifest an equity in that there is a righteousness and uprightness of my thinking, my intentions, and my actions. My actions are aligned with my intentions. My intentions are aligned with my thoughts so that I am one whole man. And I'm not living a pretend life. I'm not living in falseness. And let me say one more thing on this before we move on, and we'll move to another Old Testament passage here in a minute that correlates. But if I am living in inequity in myself, a falseness whereby my actions don't align with my motives, intentions, thoughts, or desires, there's something wrong. And then the next thing I have to assess is are my actions wrong, or are my intents and desires and motives wrong? And for many of us who are in generally conservative Christian circles, normally we'd say, well, the actions are probably right, but my heart's not in it. And the solution is not to throw away the good things in order to align my actions with my heart. The solution is to figure out why my heart is not there, to work on my heart. And this is something that has, within our circles, has been a bit of a, We see a lot with young people when they leave the church. They see the hypocrisy whereby people's hearts are not aligned with actions. And instead of saying, okay, so my heart needs to be right, can I do these things with a right heart? And to be honest, the majority of what churches like ours do, as far as actual active things, there's a lot of right there. They say, well, I'm going to get rid of the actions to align the actions with my heart. And that's a little bit of a backwards idea. If something is right to be doing, the hypocrisy that might compel us to, that which might compel us to see hypocrisy should not say, well, scratch what I'm doing that is pure and right and clean and good because it doesn't align with my heart and I don't want to be a hypocrite. Well, get your heart right and stop being a hypocrite. Right? You don't have to throw the action out, per se. You don't want to be doing the action in hypocrisy. But that doesn't necessarily mean it is the action that needs to be thrown out. Now, it may be. It may be that the action is judgmental or overly improper in some way, right? Or totally tradition or religious based and doesn't need to be there. But it may very well be that the problem in the hypocrisy is not intrinsically the action that's being asked of you, but the heart that is not aligned with it. Maybe you need to get your heart right, not necessarily dump the action. Isaiah 33:14-16 says this: "The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness hath surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? He that walketh righteously and speaketh uprightly, he that despiseth the gain of oppressions, that shaketh his hand from holding of bribes, that stoppeth his ears from hearing of blood, and shutteth his eyes from seeing evil, he shall dwell on high. His place of defense shall be the munitions of rock. Bread shall be given him, his water shall be sure." We see a very similar idea here, except instead of beginning with who will dwell among in the tabernacle, it's who will dwell in the fire. And then instead of actually answering the question with the "these people will dwell in the fire," it actually goes to "these are the people that won't." And we see several, and as we continue in the psalm, we'll see several of these same concepts here. Walketh righteously, speaketh uprightly. Don't get distracted from this, from how important it is that we be entire, that we don't walk in hypocrisy. Now we see a negative here. So verse 2 defined this man who will dwell in the tabernacle and who will abide with the Lord in a positive manner. With this man who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. Not that truth just comes out of his lips, but it has begun in the heart and it works itself out of his lips, right? Who is honest with himself, who is honest with who he is, who lives as an extension of who he is, who's not trying to pretend. Verse 3 defines this man negatively by what he is not. And we've talked about this many times. Sometimes it's more helpful to defining something to know what it isn't than what it is. And so this man does not backbite with his tongue, nor doeth evil to his neighbor, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor. And this is still an integrity issue. He does not, about what he does not say, he does not backbite. This is interesting. This word backbite, it's used 24 times in the Old Testament, and every other time you find this word, it's actually translated spy. So when the spies were sent into the land of Canaan, this is the word. The idea of spying out land, to go on foot, and it by extension means to slander. The idea is that a gossip or a slanderer goes out. He spies out others with the purpose of slandering them or with the purpose of tearing them down. He is going about seeking for vulnerabilities in others. And I can't help but see in this a correlation to hypocrisy. I had mentioned on Sunday night about one of the conversations I'd had with one of the women in the jail of late who has been struggling because there's so much drama in the unit. And she had wondered, why is it that there has to be so much drama all the time? So much drama. And I gave her a couple of reasons. The first reason is that majority of the people in this age group, majority of them would be anywhere from Gen Z to millennial age, right? Grew up on sitcoms. And sitcoms are drama-based. So they grew up understanding life through the lens of drama. That regular life, which is what a sitcom is intended to represent, was simply a series of dramas, drama, and conflict, right? Every episode had to have conflict or else everyone would sit there and be bored, and then they'd turn off the television because they're bored because there's no conflict. And so they grow up watching every week standard family life being conflict, 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 drama, 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 conflict. And then they look at their lives and they say, wow, my life is so boring. Right? And so they have to do what? In order to feel like they're living, they have to stir up drama. But there's something else, and I believe this is all the more important. And that is that when at once I stop looking at others and judging others and backbiting toward others, and I stop judging others. I start seeing myself. See, the ability to be in some drama allows me to choose a side. And if I'm on a side, then I get to feel like I'm righteous because I get to feel like I'm right. And because I'm on a side, that means I get to look at somebody that's on the other side and I get to think that they're bad or they're wrong. And so I don't have to consider myself because I get to instead consider them. And I get to focus on them. And this is what hypocrites do. This is what they have to do. Hypocrites have to be constantly looking out towards others, because if they stop looking at others, then they have to look at themselves and they're not going to like what they see. And so they are constantly focused, looking at other people. And so this man who is entire, this man who walks uprightly, works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart, is a man who is not going to backbite. He's not going to slander. He's not going to be insidious. He's not going to tear down. He's not going to do evil to his neighbor. He's not going to take up a reproach against his neighbor. He doesn't seek evil. He does not. His mind is not filled with malice. His mind is not filled with mischief. What he does not think. So what he does not say, right? He doesn't backbite with his tongue. What he does not do. He doesn't seek evil upon a neighbor. His mind is not filled with malice. What he does not think. He does not belittle others. He does not take up a reproach against a neighbor. He does not take up offenses against others. He is not a conflict-minded person. He is living in honesty and integrity. And one of the interesting things about people who live in honesty and integrity, and I hope you've realized this, I can put up with a lot of things, but I really struggle with people that aren't honest. Because, especially as a pastor, you know, we all have our own struggles. But when a person is not honest with me, I can't help them. When a person's in the jail is lying through their teeth to me. Okay, you have lied about who you are. You've misrepresented yourself because I guess you're trying to impress me. But I'm not sitting here taking my time out of my week to be impressed by you. I'm sitting here to help you. And I don't need you to impress me. I need you to tell me who you are so that I can help you get from where you are to where you need to be, because that's what I'm doing here, right? And the idea here, this measure of self-reflective humility, not belittling others, not taking up reproaches against his neighbor, not living in any sort of a dishonesty or seeking to tear down, but he's living, he is who he is, and he's seeking for others to do the same. Verse 4, in whose eyes a vile person is contemned, but he honoreth them that fear the Lord. He that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not. We get into more integrity here in just a minute. Before I get into this verse, any thoughts? I kind of got on a roll there. Thoughts, questions, concerns, disagreements? Sarah, is that a hand? No? Sam?
I just thought one thing that stuck out to me at the beginning there was just the idea that we can often fall into this too, but that our relationship with the Lord has to do with proximity to a place.
Hmm. Yeah, it is interesting. Good. Other thoughts? A continued description, and we're back to the positive here. In whose eyes a vile person is contemned. This idea, to contemn is to reject. And it's a rejection not of the person himself, but the character, right? It is not the idea here that a vile person, you look at that person as if that person is, a leper. And that's the religious idea, right? The religious idea is that you look at a person and you connect the person's actions to the person himself, and so you reject the whole person. And you turn the person away to the door, you give them the cold shoulder because of their actions. And what we're actually seeing here is the idea of a rejection of the character of the vile person. And then honoring them that fear the Lord, honoring the character of the person that fears the Lord, rejecting the character of the vile person. So there is this idea, and this is a very similar thought to Psalm 1, right? Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. And so this is that idea that the man who delights in the law of the Lord, it contemns the vile person who does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly, does not stand in the way of sinners, does not sit in the seat of the scornful. He sees those things, and see, the reason why he rejects them or he contemns them is because he is a whole person. He is whole. And in that he is whole, he is living out the reality of who he is to walk in a manner to interact with the vile person, to interact with the character of the vile person, is actually like an oil and water type situation, right? He has no desire unto the kind of thought, action, interaction that a vile person would bring about. He doesn't want to be around that kind of a person because that kind of a person is a person who is calling him to a different manner of living. And because he is an entire person, this man of integrity, this man who is whole, in order for him to do these vile actions, he has to take with him his heart. And so because he does not want his heart to be in that place of vileness, his actions will not be in that place of vileness, which means there is now no compatibility between himself and this vile person because of this vile person's character. Much to the opposite, there is an honor among those who fear the Lord. And this is where we receive a measure of warning about the nature of our associations, right? There is an inevitability and a rightness to the idea that we associate that we will interact with the unbelieving world. If we do not interact with the unbelieving world, we cannot win the unbelieving world, right? This is what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6. He says, I wrote unto you not to keep company with fornicators, yet not altogether with fornicators of this world, else you must come out of this world. But I wrote unto you that if any man calls himself a brother, is a fornicator, with such an one know not to eat. What does it mean? It means that I am going to step out into a world of unbelievers and I am going to interact with them and I'm going to expect them to be sinners because they're sinners. And I'm going to expect them to be wicked because they are lost in their wickedness, because it's all they know, because it's who they are. No matter how much they're trying to do right, they are defined by their sin nature. They are defined by that which is outside of Christ. But if I have someone who calls himself a brother, I am not going to enter into a brotherly relationship with a man who is walking outside of that which is defined by the fear of the Lord. Because in order to do so would be for me to operate in my most natural capacity, but in dissonance to my my integrity. A brother who is walking in sin and asking for fellowship is asking me to walk out of the integrity of my own heart, to interact in a manner that is at odds with who I am because I am. He's asking me to treat him as a brother, and so to trust and to love and to interact on that level of spiritual fellowship, while simultaneously he is walking contrary to sound doctrine. And so this man who is interacting both with the vile person and the man that fears the Lord, and who contemns the vile person in that man's actions, and who honors the man who fears the Lord, he is a man who will stand up for truth and who will seek unto it. As we see from this last statement, he that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not. A man who will say what is true, even if it's to his own hurt or his own detriment, he will not change himself to advantage himself in the occasion. He will not reduce his integrity, because he's a whole person, right? He is entire. He lives out of the entirety of who he is. He lives out of the fullness of himself. He does not live in personal contradiction. And because he does not live in personal contradiction, because he is whole and he is entire, he swears to his own hurt and he does not change. If what is asked of him in order to be right and to have integrity comes with some personal loss or some personal sacrifice, that's going to happen, because he is not going to change himself for personal advantage. And this is integrity. We might call this the integrity psalm. This is a definition of a person with integrity. And that's the man who will stand before the Lord. Is a man who is entire. A man who is not hypocritical. Thoughts? Sam? Yep.
And that Christ came to be that for us. That he fits all these things. And it doesn't necessarily, not that it's not something we should aspire to, but I mean, you would look at David's life and he doesn't meet all these.
Yep.
And it is a lofty goal, but a good definition of technique.
And it is a lofty goal, and one that is, as you said, only fulfilled in its entirety in Christ. And the blessing of us being in Christ is that we thus, in the eyes of God, stand in this, but not in our own merit. And it is important to understand that the man that stands before God is the man that is this way, because this is who God is, but no man can stand there in his own merit. Although we strive unto this. And we can, right, be men and women of integrity. And that is what we ought to strive unto. And it ought to become a foundational principle of our lives that we are going to be men and women of integrity. And that will sometimes mean that we must operate to our own hurt. That must sometimes mean, child, that mom and dad comes home and says, who knocked that over? Who broke that? How did this happen? And you have to speak to your own hurt on this, because you are going to be whole. You are going to be entire. You are going to be who you are, and you're going to own what you have done. And so you are going to speak to your own hurt and change not. And that's integrity. And same with in the job, at your work. Make a mistake and you own it. Because that's integrity. It's the same with me when I preach from behind the pulpit. I say something wrong. I get up and I correct it and I own it. And that's integrity. And that's who we ought to be. Good. Sarah.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. And from the idea of to swear to one's own hurt, people don't typically, and there's a couple of different ways that we could think through that. The first would be, as you said, you promise, you shake hands, you enter into a verbal or otherwise contract, and now you are bound, right? And even if things don't work out the way you expected, which is why Jesus says swear not at all, but even if things don't work out as you would expect, you're going to hold up your end because you said you would do so. The other thought is, or is this a person who, knowing that the scenario as it plays out will be to his own hurt, is still willing to make the promise because it's right before my neighbor, or it's right before the Lord, that I look at a brother and I say, by binding myself to you in this way, as God did with us, I am actually binding myself knowing the hurt that is going to come to me, but it is what is best for you, so I am going to bind myself anyway. I am going to put myself out there for you. And both of those could be the idea here of swearing to one's own hurt, but not changing. We're all going to be in a different place, and we're going to have our flaws. A great number of flaws can be worked through in their right time and in their right way, as long as you're honest with yourself. One of the things, when I started growing in leadership, and one of my first major seasons of spiritual leadership was when I was down at college and they made me what was called a floor leader. So I was in charge of a floor of guys. I don't know, how many people were on a floor? 60, something like that, Sarah? Give or take? 60 people, and I had responsibilities to make sure that they were in bed at lights out, and to make sure that their rooms were clean in the morning, and all of these things. And one of the things I started noticing about leadership, or when you gain a measure of spiritual responsibility, is that there are people who are ready for it, and there are people who aren't ready for it. And the people who are ready for it, great, they're ready for it. But the people who aren't ready for it, they aren't quite there yet. When they get put into a position of leadership for which they're not fully prepared, or when a responsibility is placed upon them for which they are not fully equipped, they can go in one of two directions. They can either pretend, or they can grow. They can get proud, pretend to be something that they're not, to look a part. And the interesting thing about it is this: the moment that you start pretending to be something that you aren't, you stop growing. You say, well, I'll just pretend to be this thing until I get there. It doesn't work that way. As long as you're living in hypocrisy, you're so busy living the facade, you're not growing anymore. You're so busy living in pride that the humility isn't there. You can't grow in humility while you're standing in pride. But the man who acknowledges his flaws, recognizes he's not there yet, and humbly grew into the position would actually grow and would proceed. And I think whether we want to talk about various men who step into pastorate roles or parents, I don't know that any parent is ready when they have kids. And I don't know that any parent is ready for each season of a child's life. When it's time for the next step in a child's life, for them to take the next spiritual step. And I have to figure out now, how am I going to guide my children through that? But there's a couple of ways it can go. One of the ways is, as a parent, I can pretend to be something I'm not. And the motive for that is give the children something to aspire to. But what it's actually doing is showing the children how to live a fake life. Because they see it. They have to see it. They live with you. You. When people live with you, they see it, right? Or you can just make the mistakes, correct them, get better, grow, and stay humble. And that is integrity. And that's where blessing is found. Other thoughts on this? Verse 5, he that putteth not out his money to usury, nor taketh reward against the innocent, he that doeth these things shall never be moved. Back to the negative, right? So we went positive, negative, positive, negative. What he is, what he isn't. What he is, what he isn't. He does not charge interest. That's the idea of putting out his money to usury There are those that also interpret this the other way. He doesn't play the markets as ill-gotten gain, right? So the one side says it's the idea of playing the markets. I don't think that that one's quite as clear because of the use of the word usury, which means to charge interest, right? The idea is more so this, I believe, this idea of not charging interest. In other words, there's no ulterior, this is integrity. There's no ulterior motive to generosity. It's not, sure, I'll give you money, but I expect it back plus interest. Okay, so now it's a money-making endeavor. It's not actually a generosity endeavor. But instead, this man is who he is. He's going to give you money, and he's going to be honest with you, and he's going to say, this is what I'm giving you, and this is what I'm asking back. And there's an integrity element to that, right? And this goes back to Leviticus 25:37, which says not to charge interest to a brother. So this is connected directly to Levitical law, right? I'm not saying that any situation where one would charge interest is necessarily wrong. That's not what I'm saying this evening at all. I would think, particularly among brothers, Christians, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have any sort of a interest idea. But I'm not saying that there's no scenario in which interest is a valid idea. But the example here, in connection with the Levitical law, is that I am not going to be generous to my brother, or say I'm being generous to my brother, with the backhanded idea of getting more on the back end. Because I'm a man of integrity. I am who I am. He does not take a reward against the innocent. Bribe to wrong an innocent party. This is from Deuteronomy 16:19, which speaks to the idea that a gift blinds the eyes of the justice. And so judges were said not to take gifts. And I've talked to you about this. Some of you have heard about this. We've talked about it in Sunday school, about the nature, even as a pastor, of taking gifts. I've seen churches before where I've been very uncomfortable with the kinds of gifts individuals in the church have given to their pastor. Because at what point does the pastor feel as though he can no longer stand up against somebody in the church because that person has done so much for them? Because that person has given them so much. Or maybe gives the church so much, right? But particularly individual gifts. Because gifts blind the eyes of objectivity. And so I've talked about that conflict in my heart where God's people are supposed to bless the man who is giving them the word. And yet simultaneously, the danger of gifting, particularly larger gifts or extravagant gifts or whatever it might be, because of the conflict that it can bring about in one's life when there's a position of authority and there's gifts involved. And so the taking a reward against the innocent would be the idea that you have been bribed in some way, whether directly or indirectly, and thus you make an unjust decision against someone because you have taken a gift or a bribe of some sort, taken a reward against the innocent. And then the final bit here, he that doeth these things, both what he does do and what he doesn't do, this man is immovable. And the idea of being an immovable man is not that you're a sinless man, as we've said. It's not that you are this in perpetuity, but you are this in principle. You're a man of principle, right? You're a man who is not going to sway. You're a man who is steady and who people can look to and rely upon, that you're not going to be swayed by public opinion. You're not going to be swayed by gifts or rewards. You are who you are. You don't change. Now again, you're not perfect, but you are who you are. And that lends a measure of consistency to you, whereby people can rely upon you. And this kind of a man is also a man who has that measure of humility by which he is who he is. And as he is who he is before the Lord, A man who walks in righteousness, because he's not just a man that is doing right things, but he is an entire person. He is who he is. The right things that he is doing is reflective of the heart that he has before the Lord, and that is the kind of man that stands before the Lord. A man of integrity. A man who shall not be moved. And the exhortation is that we be this kind of person. You may not have all of your ducks in a row. You may not have it all figured out, but are you who you are? Or are you pretending to be something you're not? Are you living in integrity? Setting aside what you look like, what you do, what you say, what you don't say, where you go, where you don't go, are you doing all of those things or not doing all of those things in the integrity of your heart? Or is there a double-mindedness there? God does not bless double-mindedness. That man is unstable in all his ways. God does not bless the proud. He resists the proud. He gives grace to the humble. Are you a man? Are you a woman of integrity? And that's the question of the psalm. Final thoughts. Yes, Paul. Is your what?
Your brain.
Brain?
Yeah.
Yep.
That's why I want the kingdom.
Oh, very good. Very good. Yes. So our choices come from our mind, which is driven by our spirits to make decisions. And we make a man of integrity is a person whose actions, whose decisions are the same as what's in his mind. He doesn't think one thing and do another. The thing he's thinking is also the thing he's doing. And that's integrity. Very good. Okay, we'll stop there.
Thank you for listening to Pastor Jamin Wickler from Legacy Baptist Church in Buffalo, Minnesota. More information about Legacy Baptist Church and a library of sermons are available at www.legacybaptistchurch.net.